I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/recommend today.
Welcome to Tigers in 20, a Go Tigers 247 audio podcast, your one-stop shop for all things University of Memphis Tigers athletics. Here are your hosts, founder of Go Tigers 247, Brooks Hansen, and lead writer for Go Tigers 247, Christian Fowler.
What's up, everybody, and welcome to this week's episode. I'm your host, Christian Fowler, and joining me, as always, is Go Tigers 247 founder, Brooks Hansen, and Go Tigers 247 digital content creator, Kenny Stubblefield. And guys, it happened. We had football on Saturday night. It's something that we didn't know if it was going to happen initially. We finally made it there. We talked about it last week on the podcast, how excited we were that it was upcoming. Now Memphis has played their first game of the season, 13-point win over Arkansas State, moved to 1-0. How exciting was it for you guys to watch football again?
Man, it was tremendous. You know, I think one thing that was the first takeaway for me is that football on TV during Corona takes up like a third of your day with one game. It's crazy.
It's a freak.
But yeah, man, it was awesome. I mean, being able to sit back on the couch and just chill with a beer and watch some football for once and not have to like watch some dumb Netflix documentary was like the highlight of my weekend.
Yeah, it was a long game, man. Brooks, I think, texted halfway through and was like, or at the very end was like, this is going to be a 4-hour game. It was funny, man. It was very long. But it was good. It was good to see the team back out there.
Yeah, I was at the Liberty Bowl from about 5:15 until about 12:30-ish. So it was a long day for me too. But yeah, like you guys said, very exciting. Was happy to be back and watch the team again. And all things considered, I think it was a good performance. I don't think it was perfect by any means. No one expected it to be with the situation and what's going on and no spring practice and limited fall camp. I don't think anyone, well, I take that back. People definitely expected Memphis to be perfect, but they should not have. There's no reason to expect a team that barely gets any practice to, you know, not have penalties or have a turnover or have some mistakes on, you know, a certain side of the ball. So I did see plenty of people that were like, oh my God, we're terrible, we suck, after like 10 minutes into the game, which is always aggravating, but that fans are going to be fans. As far as the defensive side of the ball goes, it was ugly for the first couple of possessions. They cleaned it up, looked really good throughout the game. On the offensive side of the ball, I know they had a couple of drives stall, but for the most part, dominant offense that we're used to seeing. The backfield didn't really miss a beat without Kenny Gainwell. I thought Rodriguez Clark ran hard downhill, made tacklers fear him, which is what you have to do as a running back. Went over 100 yards in his first career start. Kylan Watkins looked really dynamic. I thought Asa Martin was going to be used more than Kylan. But they got Kylan involved in the passing game and the running game. I think Asa only had one touch throughout the game. Tim Taylor got a couple touches. Marquavius Weaver was in there for a couple plays. So they used a ton of running backs in the game. If you ask me, it's, you know, to get those guys some run to see what you have in the backfield in live game action, because a lot of those guys either haven't played or haven't played much. And then as far as it goes with Brady White, still looks like one of the better quarterbacks in college football. Devontae Coxey is going to be Devontae Coxey. He's going to shit talk the whole game. He's going to, you know, put his hands on receivers and get them out of his way and make big catches. And then someone that I've been looking forward to the entire offseason that we've talked about plenty of times, even after the game on Saturday, was Sean Dykes. I mean, a guy with tremendous receiving ability as a tight end, was really overshadowed by Joey Magnifico throughout his career. And then had the injury last year that forced him to miss most of the season. Came out 10 catches, 137 yards, 2 touchdowns. Couldn't ask for a better performance than that. I said it a couple times during the game. I won't be surprised at all if he breaks Memphis's single season tight end receiving record. I think I said that halfway through the game, and he ended with 140 yards. So overall, I think it was a solid performance. And you know, for you guys, obviously watching it at home, having a little bit of a better vantage point than me. Who stuck out the most? Like, I mean, I know I mentioned a lot of players, but who were you guys the most impressed with on Saturday night?
I mean, personally, I know he didn't get a ton of play, and I wish that I'd seen more returns, but Gabe Rogers looks like he could be special this year. You know, minus that one, that penalty was horrible.
Terrible.
I mean, that was terrible.
Yeah.
And two, I think he tripped up on his own shoestring, but, you know, like that was dynamic. That was, I mean, for me, I'm looking forward to seeing him get that ball on returns all season long. That's the dude that I'm looking for an exciting play. So he stood out. You know, I feel like some of Memphis's defensive backs were really good. One guy that we talked about leading up to this game was Jaleel Clemens, and he kind of was non-existent for me. I mean, maybe I'm not seeing the nuances of the defense like you might, but I honestly expected to see a little bit more from him. So really looking forward to seeing what he does the rest of the year to see if he can live up to our hype.
Yeah, for me, on the offensive side of the ball, and we've heard this every year that he's been here, he's finally healthy. But I remember Christian saying at when we were in Dallas for the Cotton Bowl, Christian said after seeing a couple of practices and watching some warm up stuff, he looked at me and he said, "I think Brady White's finally healthy. I think his legs are finally healthy." Because even in the Cotton Bowl, you saw a lot more mobility in the pocket. You saw him running more, and then you saw it in full force this past week against Arkansas State. He made some moves. He was slick in the pocket. You know, he avoided rushers in a really clever way, and then ran out and got a, I think, what was his longest rush? Was it 18 yards? I think something like that.
Yeah,
like,
it was definitely over 10 to 15 yards, somewhere in that range.
And I don't think you would have seen him do that. You know, I think he was obviously still recovering from his foot injury that he had when he first got here. And then obviously just being dinged up, you know, a little bit last year, but I think he's healthy this year. And so that was impressive. Brooks texted us, I think, in the middle of the game, and he said, as a wide receiver, and I agreed with him on this, Taj Washington is going to be a dynamic receiver for the Tigers, I think. Brooks, what did you see that made you point out Taj Washington?
Yeah, I mean, he's just, one, he's super fast. He's physical as a receiver. He, to me, honestly, I know he's listed at 5'11", but he looks bigger than that on the field. I don't know if it's his physicality that does it for him, or if just the guys he was matched up against on Saturday were smaller DBs. But, I mean, he looked like a freshman that came in ready to play right away. So he may not put up the numbers, but I think he adds a presence on the edge for Memphis in that receiver slot that gives them an option that keeps guys honest with, you know, DeMonte Coxie and, you know, Sean Dykes coming from the inside. I mean, Dykes was – he looked like a slot receiver tight end. I mean, he was that good.
Yeah, I think you make a really good point that a lot of people may miss about these other receivers, because if Calvin Austin and Taj Washington weren't doing what they were supposed to be doing and getting open and forcing defensive backs' hands and defensive coordinators' hands, then DeMonte Coxie and Sean Dykes aren't running open all game. So I know Calvin had a couple drops. He didn't have a clean game at all. I think a lot of that's, like I said, just jitters being the first game of the season. I think Calvin continues to get better throughout the year. We saw what he could do last year. Taj seemed to be open the majority of the game. He's just a really good route runner, a versatile guy that can play inside and out. You know, I get a little carried away when I talk football, so if I'm going too long, stop me, because I want to hit on a lot of the points you guys made. And first with Kenny talking about Brady, and it's something that we saw in the Cotton Bowl last year with the mobility. It came out of nowhere. He got a couple weeks off after the conference championship game into the Cotton Bowl and looked like a completely different quarterback. I thought that was the best game he ever played in a Memphis uniform. I know it wasn't a win. I know it wasn't a perfect game. But as far as the throws that he made from off-balance stances, from his back foot, from rolling left and throwing right, to me, that was his best game at Memphis as far as just being mobile and his arm. And then you saw that mobility carry over. I've heard some people say that he may have been dealing with an ankle injury last year, like an ankle sprain or something that was really hindering him last year. I don't know if he was or not. It's not something I've picked and prodded and asked about, especially, you know, coaches like Norvell don't talk about injuries. But to me, it looks like he is a completely healthy player at this point. He's running around. He's not slow. He's a better athlete than you would think he is and than what he's shown for the most of his career. So him going forward, I mean, Memphis is just lucky. We talked about it when Kenny Gainwell left, to have a veteran quarterback who is very good like Brady White. He's going to be the player that more than likely floats this offense all year. Brooks, you mentioned Jaleel Clemens. I think he had 3 hurries on the night. He didn't have any sacks or any noticeable stats, which is why you mentioned the nuances. Sometimes it's hard when it comes to defensive players to see how much impact they have on a game. But Jaleel, I can think of a couple plays where he came off the ball extremely fast, got into the backfield, and forced a throw or, you know, forced an incompletion. There was one screen play where they let him go, and he was back there for the quarterback, even had time to turn around and throw a screen pass. But he was not my biggest defensive standout. I thought the linebackers, which is something that Silverfield has talked about a ton throughout the offseason, were both really, really good. I thought JJ and Xavier Cullens, very good games. I think Zay had 7 tackles, interception, and a sack. He was all over the field. JJ Russell had a forced fumble and a pass breakup on the, you know, Arkansas State's last offensive play. He had that pass breakup. So that's what you need. I mean, veteran linebackers are going to be all over the field. They didn't rotate linebackers as much as I thought they would. It was a lot of JJ and Zay. And then Quindell, who I think is one of the best players on the defense, didn't start, which was weird. It was Tyrez and Sanchez Blake that started, and then they started kind of rotating Quindell in on the second or third series, and he played more as the game went out. I think Quindell's a player that should be on the field on every play, and because when he's on the field, good things happen. You saw the screen that he absolutely crushed in the backfield, a great center fielder at the safety position, and somebody who can come up and lay a hit. So those 3 guys for me stood out. O'Brien was really good up front. He always is. He doesn't get enough credit, especially being an undersized guy playing 3-4 nose tackle when he has for the majority of his career at Memphis other than last year. So I know a lot of people were down on the defense. A lot of people were like, our defense is terrible again. What happened? I don't think that's the case. New scheme, new coaches, some new personnel. Obviously, they were dealing with some things on Saturday. Thomas Pickens, who was listed as a starter, didn't play. There was a couple other guys, I can't remember off the top of my head, that were listed on the 2-deep that didn't play or didn't get in the game. So we don't really know what was going on there. But they definitely had some attrition that they were dealing with on Saturday night that, you know, that plays a role. And then, like I said, new scheme, new coordinator, a completely new defensive staff. A solid offense in Arkansas State, and they hung 30 on SMU last year. They've got guys that can play. And after those, I mean, Arkansas State scored 14 points on 2 of their first 3 possessions and finished with 24 points. So I don't think there's anything to worry about. They get this week off, they get a bye week, and then they come out against Houston back at home. I think that defense looks completely different the next time we see them on September 19th.
Christian, you don't have to apologize for talking too much about football, because I love talking with you about football, because you add perspective that I don't think Brooks and I can, because you just know the game so well. But there's 2 things I wanted to ask you about, Christian. I want to get your thoughts, and you can answer both of these in the same monologue, I guess. But what did you think about the offensive line? How did they do, you know, kind of a newer offensive line, especially when you lose your anchor and Dustin Woodard? How did they do against Arkansas State? And then I wanted to ask you about this article that I read that was written a couple of days after the Arkansas State game by the draftnetwork.com. A guy named Carter Donick wrote an article about Brady White. And this is I'm just going to read one line to you, and you can break it down because I'm sure you've read it. But he says, "Don't let the sparkling 275 yards and 4 touchdowns on just 36 attempts fool you. Memphis quarterback Brady White showed us exactly who we thought he was in Saturday's emphatic win over Arkansas State, the definition of average. What are your thoughts on that and the offensive line? And you can just go.
So I'll start on the offensive line. I thought it was a good performance. They had some pre-snap penalties. They weren't perfect by any means. A lot of shifting has gone on that offensive line. You got Dylan Parham kicking from guard to tackle. I thought he played an extremely clean game. If Dylan Parham was Obina Eze's size, he might be the best offensive lineman in college football, and I truly believe that he is that talented, especially as an undersized guy. So you have him moving from guard to tackle, Manny and Ronald Lopez moving from guard to center. Evan Fields is one of the guys that I mentioned was listed on the two deep, didn't make it. He was or didn't play on Saturday, was listed as a starting right guard. He didn't play. Then you had Obina and Titus Jones were rolling in and out at left tackle, which is something that Memphis does that's a little bit different than other schools. It's way more popular in college to roll offensive linemen than it is in the NFL. NFL, the five that are out there are going to be the five that are out there. In college, you'll see some more bodies thrown out there. So no surprise. I mean, that we don't know what's happening. I mean, Obina could have been dealing with injuries. It could just be them rotating guys to keep them fresh because it's the first game of the year. But I thought everyone that played did a pretty good job. Isaac Ellis is an absolute animal. He's a guy that has some plays that he'll take off plays, which is something that you want to clean up and correct. And once again, a lot of that can be with it being the first game and not a lot of preparation time and just being gassed. Go back and watch Rodriguez Clark's touchdown. Dreek's touchdown run up the middle. The only reason he scored is because of Isaac Ellis. So you had, I think it was still Obina at left tackle. It was either Obina or Titus Jones, and Isaac plays left guard. So Isaac was comboing to the DN and working his way up to the second level. So he combos on the DN, completely shoves him on his inside shoulder to the left tackle's outside shoulder. So he's out of the play, which is why that hole was so big. And then he combos up. Typically, you'd combo up to a linebacker, but the linebackers were all blocked. The safety was coming down. Isaac Ellis absolutely destroyed the safety. And if you go back and watch it, Isaac Ellis was a one-man wrecking crew on that play. So I think the offensive line is fine. Silverfield is one of the best offensive line coaches in the country. He proved that. He still has his hand in the offensive line. Jim Bridge is a very good offensive line coach as well. So those guys are going to be fine all season. I think they have depth that they haven't necessarily had in years past. Sometimes in the past few years, it's been like, okay, they got their five, but if one of those guys goes down, they could be in trouble. I think they have a lot of depth up front. I think they'll be fine. And then as far as you said with Brady White, since he got to Memphis, has been a polarizing player. You have people that have different opinions on him. It's a lot more positive now than it was his first year with the team, but he's still pretty polarizing. There's still people that don't like him and say he's a game manager and he can't throw the ball. Here's the thing about Brady White that sets him apart. It's his mind. You watch what he does pre-snap. Not many college quarterbacks do that much pre-snap. He gets them in the right play based off of the look of the defense. He's an extremely intelligent football player. He understands defenses. He understands schemes. He understands personnel. There's a lot of college football players that do not understand that type of stuff and don't learn that stuff until they get to the NFL. So that's what sets him apart. And then as far as them saying he's average, I'm assuming a lot of that is because a lot of his throws were dink and dunk, short throws. There's only so much. I mean, it's a game plan. You have a game, whatever is called, whatever's in the game plan, whatever the offensive coordinator feels like needs to be attacked against a defense is what a quarterback's going to do. So if they felt like they had an advantage running stops and digs and hitches, which is a lot of what they did, then that's why they did that. There will be games where they open up the passing game and they go deep more. Like I said, go watch the Cotton Bowl game against Penn State. They knew they needed chunk plays. They knew how good Penn State's linebackers were and how good they are in coverage and flowing to the ball, so they went over the top a lot more. It's all dependent on game-to-game basis, what they feel like they have as mismatches and what they need to do. So I disagree with that. I don't think he's average. I saw something today on Bleacher Report that had him listed as the number 5 or number 6 overall quarterback in college football. So everyone has an opinion. That's fine. I'm not necessarily saying he's going to be a great NFL quarterback or anything like that. But as far as the college game goes, I think Brady White is well above average.
So I know that you don't like to give a lot of predictions in terms of, you said you don't know exactly what kind of quarterback Brady will be in the NFL. But at the very end of his article, he said that, you know, Connor Dunnick said that he thinks that Brady is an undrafted guy, 7th round guy at the very best. And more than likely is a third string quarterback in the NFL. What are your thoughts on that?
I think that's probably pretty accurate. I think he is a 6th to 7th round guy. I guess in theory he could slide up into the fifth round, but I don't really see that. I think if he would have been a higher draft pick, he would have already left, because I'm pretty sure he turned in his draft papers last year during the Cotton Bowl time. I don't think he's a starting quarterback in the NFL. Like I said, that's not what I'm saying. I'm not saying this is a guy that's going to go to the NFL and be a perennial Pro Bowler. But I do think that he could end up being a guy that goes to the NFL and is an asset to a quarterback room as far as a mental perspective, as far as a knowledge of the game perspective, and could have a decently long career in the NFL as a backup and as a guy that brings in knowledge to younger players when they get drafted or when they get into the league. And there's nothing wrong with that. You go make millions of dollars being a backup quarterback. You offered me that, I would take it tomorrow. So I don't think there's anything wrong with it. I don't think anyone's expecting Brady White to be a second or third round pick and go be a starter in the NFL. But like I said, I think it's perfectly fine to go be a career backup. And I'm sure you meet a lot of cool people along the way and you get to help mentor young quarterbacks. And that's something I could see him doing if he doesn't want to pursue going straight into his profession and he wants to go try the NFL for a little while. So that's pretty much what I see as a Brady White career in the NFL, if that's the option that he chooses.
All right, so we're 20 minutes in and we're all football, and I love it. We all want football and you're getting it. So let's talk about one more thing before we take a break and then try to talk a little bit about college basketball and the, can he bleep it, f***ed up NCAA. All right, so we're 9 days away. We're recording on Wednesday, September 9th. We're 9 days away from Memphis's second game against the Houston Cougars. Fingers crossed, knock on wood. I feel like I see postponements every day across the entire landscape of college football day to day right now. So 9 days. Mark it down in permanent marker. We're not going to have a delay. What does Memphis need to do between now and next Friday night to come out with their first conference win for the 2020-21 season?
Well, I think the first thing is clean up the defensive side of the ball. That's the first thing. Start faster than you did. Like I said, they got better as the game continued. But playing against a team like Houston, I know they don't have a great quarterback. And I know they do have some good receivers, but they don't necessarily have a great quarterback that's going to scare a lot of teams. I know a lot of people aren't fans of Dana Holgorsen, but he is a great offensive mind. Look at his track record. Very good offensive coach. So if he sees weaknesses that are lasting and that are going to last throughout the season, he's going to attack them, and he's probably going to attack them pretty well. So you got to clean up on the defensive side of the ball. You got to start faster. I think as far as creating turnovers, they did an incredible job. 3 turnovers. 3 sacks, 5 tackles for loss. So as far as splash plays went, they played very well. But you want to see those in-between plays, those first and second down plays that no one really pays attention to that gain 11 to 12 yards. Those are the ones that need to be cleaned up. Some of the penalties, you had a couple of after the play penalties. I thought some of them were pretty bogus. Some of the personal foul calls, the roughing the passer. I couldn't really see on the roughing the passer, but it didn't look like it from my vantage point. So you want to clean those things up, even if you felt like they were ticky-tacky calls. You don't want to cost your team 15 yards, especially if it's a third down or a big play. So clean up on defense, a little bit more efficient on offense. I thought they were very efficient, but to be a little bit more efficient as far as play calling, I know a lot of people were griping about they were running too much. They're going to be vanilla. It's a game. It's first game of the year against an out-of-conference opponent. Expect a lot different looks. That's what college football teams do, guys. They play vanilla in the first game. The first quarter when Memphis' defense was getting scored on, they weren't stunning. They weren't blitzing. They were playing straight up 3-man rushes, 4-man rushes at the most. It's not going to look like that all season. They're not going to try to show a lot in their first game, especially when their second game is their conference opener. So I expect a lot more blitzes, a lot more stunts on the defensive line, a lot more creativity on both sides of the ball. And luckily they do have, like you said, Brooks, 9 days to clean that up and to kind of prepare. And I think they're going to come out and they're not even going to look like the same football team next Friday against Houston.
I want to see pressure on the quarterback. They got to get in the backfield. There's got to be some consistent pressure, especially against a mediocre quarterback like Houston has. So I agree with you on all fronts. I think just getting real game reps and watching it on film is going to be extremely helpful just to clean things up penalty-wise. So I'm looking forward to seeing what kind of improvement Memphis can make in the next 9 days. So let's take a quick break. We'll come back on the other side and talk NCAA basketball.
When something happens to your kitchen, you might say,
"This is ludicrous."
But that won't fix your home. That will only get you the rapper, Ludacris.
Having trouble? Don't panic. Don't be alarmed. You need to file a claim? Holla at State Farm. Like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
That's right. You can file a claim on the app or call us.
Thanks, Mr. Chris.
No matter how ludicrous the situation, like a good neighbor, State Farm is there.
State Farm, Bloomington, Illinois.
Okay, picture this. It's Friday afternoon when a thought hits you. I can waste another weekend doing the same old whatever, or I can conquer it. I can hop into my all-new Hyundai Santa Fe and hit the road. Any road. The steeper, the better. Because my all-new Santa Fe is available with H-Track all-wheel drive, so I can hit the trail without a worry in the world. Heck, with three rows and best-in-class rear cargo space, I can pack the whole family in with all our gear. We've got available dual wireless charging for our phones, so we'll never lose touch with civilization, and we won't lose touch with the primordial power of Mother Earth. So which is it? Waste the weekend or do something a little more epic? And conquer it in the all-new Hyundai Santa Fe. Visit HyundaiUSA.com or call 562-314-4603 for more details. Hyundai, there's joy in every journey.
All right, welcome back, everybody. So yeah, it's full-blown college basketball time, NCAA time. First, I want to give a shout-out to South Alabama. I don't typically do this, but Michael Flowers is a transfer from Western Michigan who was the first official denial from the NCAA that came out yesterday. Western Michigan essentially lied to the kid and has lied publicly about the facts of his transfer waiver request. And it's pretty pathetic to see that the NCAA in a situation where the school is not cooperating decided to deny his immediate eligibility. It's just pathetic. So that's what I was alluding to with the fucked up NCAA. But in other weird NCAA news, Kenny, you texted as soon as this hit the wire. It was very strange to see this morning the ACC and all of its coaches decided to vote internally and make a recommendation to the NCAA to expand the NCAA tournament to every single Division I school, like 350 whatever schools. Are they crazy? What are they thinking?
Well, that's my question. That was my question to you two. I was like, what is going on here? What is the motivation behind this? Because, and I know that there's a lot of apologists out there that are going to say, you know, and let's not beat around the bush here. This is a Mike Krzyzewski, you know, led deal. He's the guy who pulls the strings, not just in the ACC, but also in the NCAA in its entirety. But I know there's a lot of apologists out there. They're going to say, well, he wants inclusion for everybody. And I don't buy it. I don't buy that. And so I wondered, that's what I was asking you guys. And I don't have any insight into, you know, the motivation behind it other than, you know, as a conspiracy theorist, which I readily am, is he trying to make a power play against Mark Emmert and the NCAA, you know, governing body saying, hey, whatever plans you think you might have, we're going to push something else through? Because, you know, the main takeaway from it is that the coaches from the ACC are saying foregoing all conference tournaments, we're going to just allow everybody into the NCAA tournament. And that to me is just, number one, I don't see how it happens. I don't see how they do it. And then that effectively says, with Mark Emmert coming out and saying, we're looking towards a bubble situation, a bubble type thing where, man, how do we have, it's going to be hard to have, you know, 64 teams. It's going to be hard to do 32 teams. We can possibly make 16 teams work in a bubble type situation. But, and then the next day it comes out, Krzyzewski's like, hey, how about 350 teams in the NCAA tournament? And I just don't know what the motivation is. I don't know why that is even a topic of conversation. I don't see it happening. But those are just my thoughts, Brooks. Well, you're the NCAA guru.
I mean, just think about this. We're having a hard enough time envisioning college basketball with a non-conference schedule this year. You know, you're talking about a game-to-game scenario where any given game could be canceled because, you know, basketball's not like football to where you have 80 to 90 players on roster and you lose four guys that are in your two deep and you keep trucking. You lose four guys for a basketball team and contact tracing that goes along with that. If you have two dudes that test positive and you all of a sudden you have to bubble your team for 14 days.
It's over.
It's over.
Cancellations.
It's over. You know, the TBT had teams dropping out left and right. You know, Memphis's Cody Toppert's team, Eberline Drive, got dropped the day before their first game over a false positive. So you're talking about suddenly expanding a tournament from, you know, 65 teams to now going to 353 teams. And we're talking about just simple math, 13 scholarship players, four primary coaches. You've got support staff, a minimum of 25 people per team that are a part of their internal bubble, minimum. And upwards of 40, at a minimum, you're looking at about 9,000 total people between the entire NCAA and that's just teams, 9,000 people. How do you control that? How do you bubble that? I just don't see it even being remotely feasible. I think the chaos would be wonderful. I mean, I think it would be like straight up chaos, but and shout out to Brian Snow of 247 Sports, national recruiting guy. He had a funny tweet. He said, when the news broke, he said, someone quick do a FOIA request for all the ACC coaches bonuses if they make the NCAA tournament. He thought maybe this was about them trying to get their NCAA tournament bonus from last year. So, I don't know what to make of it. All I know is that all of college basketball has lost its mind. And, you know, you guys got any more thoughts before I get into the last little bit of NCAA news?
Let's get to it.
Let's get to it. All right. So today, this morning, the NCAA through the NABC announced that they were passing a one-time waiver for all NCAA Division I basketball teams to allow up to two non-coaching staff members to participate in general duties on court. And you would think, okay, well, that makes complete sense. You know, like if you've got your director of player development, it would make sense that the director of player development would get to work on the court where players develop, right? But that hasn't been the case. It's, you know, for those that pay attention, NCAA basketball, your head coach and three assistant coaches, official assistant coaches, are allowed to work on the court. This legislation that was approved on September the 8th allows for non-coaching staff members designated in that position to perform on-court managerial duties like rebounding, passing, assisting with drills. I mean, we're getting fancy now. But what that means for Memphis is, you know, you guys have paid attention, and especially for our VIP members, you know that there's a very good possibility that once there's a better idea of what college basketball looks like for this season, Penny Hardaway will be given permission to make an additional hire outside of the assistant hire. If and when he makes that hire will be done with this new legislation in mind. I do think it's a brilliant move for Penny Hardaway to go ahead and make the move to get that done this year. And, you know, I wish, honestly, that the NCAA would make this a permanent rule change, not just for this season.
Yeah, I completely agree. And this is something that we've talked about with some of the changes that have happened this year, including the no ACT, SAT scores. That's something that we said should stay. And I completely agree on this one as well. As you mentioned, you know, a lot of people may not even know that those types of coaches aren't allowed on the floor right now, or haven't been for some time. And it really doesn't make any sense. Like you said, there's literally a title for a basketball coach that is director of player development, which seems pretty straightforward.
Who can't develop
players. But you can't develop players because you can't be on the floor. So it's a move that makes sense. And like you said, Brooks, once Memphis's assistant coaching search and all that stuff brings more clarity, we know who's going to be hired. The hire is made, and then Penny moves on to potentially hiring another assistant in one of those director of player development spots or whatever the title is that he comes up with or decides to be, that coach is also allowed on the floor. Because when you think about what these guys bring to the table, having all of them on the floor together is just more of an advantage. It's just another guy that knows the game, that knows players, that knows player tendencies, that's more than likely done a lot of research on the players that are on the roster. And in cases where it's a guy that's been there, obviously that's not the case at Memphis, but in cases where there's a guy that's been there, he definitely knows that team very well and can add his input, not only to the coaches how he does now, having to go to the coaches and tell them what he sees, but be able to tell those guys directly on the floor. So it is a bit of a big move. It makes sense. It kind of makes you wonder why they haven't done this in the past. But hopefully it is here to stay, and hopefully some of these things that have been put into place this year are here to stay, because they make a lot more sense than what's going on right now.
I remember when we did the first episode of Coach's Corner, we had Trey, Preston, Damon Stoudemire, and Bubba Luckett on talking about assistant coaching and head coaching and all those things in between. And I remember Bubba Luckett telling us a story when he was a player at the University of Memphis. There was a coach. One of the main themes that ran through this is how head coaches are supposed to, you know, empower their assistant coaches to be able to do their job, and how a lot of times when you first come in as a head coach at a new position, you think, I've got to do everything. I'm going to do everything myself. And you don't really necessarily empower your assistant coaches to do their jobs. And Bubba told us a story about in practice while he was at the University of Memphis. This is a long time ago, how an assistant coach fell asleep underneath the basket in the middle of practice. And this reminds me of that. Like, are you going to have a basketball development coach falling asleep under the basket because they don't get to develop their players? You know what I'm saying? Like, it's hilarious. And it makes sense that they would do this. I mean, if this is about developing young dudes and young women on the court, why would you not want to have all hands on deck by the NCAA? You know, it just doesn't make sense.
Well, one day when this individual retires, I'll tell stories about a coach that was at the University of Memphis within the last 10 years who had a reputation for falling asleep in coaches' meetings. So, but that this individual is still coaching in Division I basketball, so I'll refrain from telling that story for now. But I, you know, one thing I do to kind of bring this full circle with the NCAA, I find it hilarious that the NCAA is passing legislation that continues to benefit coaches. It's coach centric. And yet one of the biggest pieces of legislation that was discussed all year leading up to the pandemic, and even going into 2019, was allowing a one-time transfer waiver. The NCAA tabled that and said, things are just too crazy right now. We can't implement a new rule that's going to create a lot more oversight. I mean, the NCAA is in the middle of announcing furloughs, where they're doing, you know, mandatory furloughs for NCAA staff. And they're saying in this new release related to these two coaches that can be on court now that there's oversight related to that. The coaches have to be identified, have to be kept on record with the athletic department compliance. They have to be submitted to the NCAA. There's oversight related to that. They approved that. They approved this coaching-centric legislation. But if it helps players, if it benefits players, if it makes sense for them, nah, fuck them. That's what the NCAA's mindset is, and it's pathetic. So I think that's all I've got to say on the NCAA this week. Guys, y'all got anything else?
I'm good.
I think next week's show is going to be very interesting, so stay tuned. I think that the next few weeks could be very, very big from a news perspective. So y'all stick in there with us. Stay tuned to Go Tigers 247. And with that, that's a wrap.
Thank you for listening to Tigers in 20. If you enjoyed this episode, we would love for you to leave a comment and a rating wherever you download your podcasts. If you are interested in daily content all about the University of Memphis athletic program, please hop over to www.gotigers247.com. Articles are uploaded daily, and you can join the Go Tigers 247 family by signing up for the VIP membership for even more behind-the-scenes information.
It's the most all-star studded challenge ever. And this time, it's every competitor for themselves.
Best challenge ever!
The Challenge All-Stars. New season now streaming on Paramount+. Go to ParamountPlus.com to try it free. Terms apply.